So, welcome to the next edition of the Rare Business Podcast. With me today, I have Bill Colleran, who is President and CEO of AnswerDash. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. How are you, Adrian?
I am very well, sir. I'm very well. So, Bill, for the benefit of our listeners and readers, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and a bit about the work that you do?
Sure. I'm currently the CEO of AnswerDash. We're a startup company here in Seattle, as you'll hear later through the podcast. We do support systems for enterprises, mostly on the web, but also chatbots and some other channels that we'll get into.
Mm-hmm.
I've been an entrepreneur for a while. Prior to joining AnswerDash about 2 years ago, I ran another company called Impinge, which is in a completely unrelated space that does RFID. And prior to that, I ran another company that made Bluetooth chips back in the day when those were something that was new and exotic and people hadn't heard of. But so a serial entrepreneur and excited to talk about what we're doing at AnswerDash.
Perfect. So correct me if I'm wrong, but sort of AnswerDash, talk about support, a large part of all of the, what you're doing is in the sort of the, the self-service space. Is that right?
That's correct. Our company was founded by some research out of the University of Washington, which is here in Seattle, and mm-hmm. it stemmed from an observation that our founders had, which was, if you understand the context of a person, you can do a surprisingly good job of predicting the questions or issues or challenges that they're having, and therefore we could build systems that would address those and allow people to self-serve, to get their own support, which tends to be better for enterprises because it's lower cost, and better for consumers because they can get answers at their fingertips, don't have to call a support number and those sorts of things. So it's a big trend. A lot of companies are going more towards self-service for those two obvious advantages, we're leveraging technology to make it all work.
Excellent. But I think the thing that I can see, Bill, is there's this idea that, I mean, yes, self-service is a huge thing, and it's both, you know, that customers want it, companies want their customers to do more of it, but I also can see and hear lots of stories of how many aren't getting it kind of right. I mean, why do you think that is? I mean, what's going wrong, you know, in that sort of meeting the need, as it were?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, self-service has been around for a long time. We're all familiar with ATMs or cash machines, and we use them, and people are very familiar with that. Mm-hmm. But it gets a lot more complicated when you're on the internet because of the range of things you're trying to accomplish is much broader.
Right.
The functionality of an ATM machine is very limited, and we kind of know what it does. And therefore, it makes it relatively easy to design a user interface that we can all understand and are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're on the internet, you know, whether it's on your desktop machine or on mobile, there's such a broad range, a myriad of things you might be trying to accomplish, that getting the user experience right so that you can deliver that self-service experience is just a lot more complicated.
Yeah.
And, you know, people have been experimenting around with different approaches over the past several years, and it's getting better, but we have a ways to go. But fundamentally, that's why it's hard, because it's very different to, you know, register for a warranty versus download a white paper versus figure out why my printer's not working. It's kind of all over the map, and it's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all kind of technology or user experience approach.
Right.
That's why it's more complicated than you might imagine.
Okay. Forgive me if this sounds kind of flippant, but it feels to me like almost like a first step along this path might be just to establish a really good set of FAQs, and that might go a long way to helping kind of many companies. Is that too simplified an approach, or is that because I also don't see very many companies that have a good set of FAQs, and that seems to be like a very simple and obvious thing to do.
Yeah, that's kind of like the price of admission, right? I mean, you're right. Having a handful of FAQs at people's disposal is a great first step. In many cases, I would argue in most cases, it's not enough. And there's a couple of challenges with FAQs. One, if you want to cover a breadth of topics, let's say because you have a complicated product offering or whatever it might be, the FAQs, if they get too long, no one's going to read through them all to find out where their question happens to be. So you're kind of limited to, I don't know, a dozen or so FAQs, maybe 20.
Okay.
And that doesn't necessarily cover the waterfront and all the topics you want to address. And so what you need is some way to have FAQ-like information, but make it more readily accessible by people.
Right.
And so one idea, obviously, is we'll have a little search engine where you can type in topics and search the FAQs.
Yeah.
And that's the next step in the right direction. And actually, what AnswerDash does is yet another step, and that is we use your context, be it what web page you might be on, where in a mobile app you are, to do that searching for you. And so at your fingertips, when you click on a button, out pop the most likely questions that you have given your context. And we typically limit it to 5 or 6 or 7 so that the user can easily scan them and get the FAQ that they want rather than having to read through a lengthy list. So I think FAQs are a good starting point, but there's a number of steps that we can evolve beyond that to make it even better so that you're not limited in the number of FAQs you have, and yet they're readily at people's disposal.
Okay. So I want to dig into kind of what you do and how things kind of work for you, because on your website it kind of says, now sit back, relax, and let AnswerDash reduce your support tickets by 30-50% and increase sales by 10-30%. And I'm thinking, yeah, they're pretty big numbers, and I'd like to kind of
how do we do that?
Tell me what the secret sauce is. It's like, can you tell me how you do that and how that works? Because that's fascinating, because there are some big numbers. If you can reduce support tickets by 30-50%, I mean, wow, why wouldn't you do that?
Sure. And so what we do applies equally to websites, to mobile apps, to chatbots. I'll describe the website experience to make it concrete.
Okay.
And as I mentioned before, what we do relies on context. And when you're browsing a website, context is typically the page that you're on, and maybe the path that you've traversed to get there.
Right.
That tells a website owner a lot about what you're trying to accomplish.
Okay.
And so what we do is we use our AI-driven prediction algorithms to predict what likely questions any given user has given their context. So if I'm on the warranties page and I click on our help button, it'll pop out, and the tab that pops out will be pre-populated with the most likely handful of questions. When a user then quickly reads through that, 5 or 6 questions and find the ones they want, they click on it and it expands to give their answer.
Right.
And all of these questions and answers can be text, they can be images, they can be video, so any kind of HTML content we can serve up. But it's based on tracking what similarly situated past users, what questions they've asked.
Yes.
And you ask a question merely by clicking on it, and assuming that similarly situated future users will have similar kinds of questions. So it's kind of crowdsourcing the popularity of the questions given context,
mm-hmm.
and it turns out to be very, very useful. If a user can click on a tab and then get an answer to their question in a couple of clicks, they tend to be much less likely to call the 1-800 support number or submit a ticket via email or whatever it might be. And although the idea is relatively simple, obviously the implementation and the complexity of our prediction algorithms are difficult, but it has a profound impact on how easily users are able to self-support. They're able to get answers that they need very quickly, and therefore that drives down submission of tickets.
Right.
On the flip side, for e-commerce, if a user is shopping and has questions about a certain product they might want to purchase, or about the return policy or the warranty or delivery times, having those answers readily at their fingertips, like the way we do with this little pop-out tab that predicts likely questions, makes it more likely that people will consummate their online transaction. They're more likely to purchase because they get their answers, or they're more likely to register or sign up for whatever it is that the website is inviting them to do, because all of those little nagging questions that might be friction towards getting to that success event, we can knock those down because we can make the answers to those questions so readily available with a few clicks. And as a consequence, we see higher conversion rates in the e-commerce setting, and as I mentioned before, lower ticket rates in the support setting. And it all stems from the same basic ideas. make the granular information available to people at their fingertips because we can predict what they need given their context.
Sure.
And that's the gist of it.
I mean, it's fascinating. I mean, the thing that I think the last part you talked about in terms of e-commerce that just speaks to this idea that, you know, cart abandonment rates are still incredibly high for, you know, and
right,
it was
right.
between 68% and 80%, depending on what industry you're in. And a large part of that is to do with sort of unforeseen postal costs or shipping costs. And I guess mm-hmm. you'll be able to handle a lot of that before people actually get shocked into the checkout bit, in many ways, I guess.
Right. And if let's say it's a big, large or heavy item and has special shipping considerations, I can find out, oh, it's going to take 7 days to deliver this. Well, now I don't have to hunt around on the website and get distracted or whatever. Just having the information at people's fingertips goes a long way to easing their concerns and having them close more deals online as a consequence.
Yeah. And so can I assume that you talked about the using artificial intelligence and clever algorithms and things. I mean, is this a self-learning system, and therefore the accuracy will improve over time, and therefore it's you end up sort of getting more and more accurate. So rather than presenting just the five options, you end up getting to the point where you end up presenting fewer options because you can the prediction of the accuracy gets better and better.
That can happen. Also, okay. The other thing, so yes, the algorithms are dynamic and they adjust to real-world circumstances and they learn and get better. And mm-hmm. so that manifests itself in two ways. One is, as you mentioned, you know, we start out and the system doesn't have a lot of data to learn from, and so it has kind of some coarse guesses, but as it gets used more and more, it gets refined. And what we do is we percolate the most interesting or most likely questions to the top of the list, and then they tend to get used more.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one area. It gets smarter and better as it goes. The other is the outstanding environment changes. Let's say you're a website selling a product and you introduce a new product, or maybe there's a bug that becomes evident in your product after a new software version is released. New questions will percolate up to the top because, you know, this week they're getting asked a lot more for whatever reason.
Right.
So a static ordering isn't really what enterprises want. They want to know what's hot today, and so it has to be dynamic in the sense that it not only learns and gets better over time, but it adapts to changing conditions to serve up the optimum information, whatever those conditions might be.
Okay. And how does the – because you mentioned chatbots as well, or you did mention chatbots. I mean, how does that sort of play into that? I mean, is that just that chatbots are handling the interactions? Because I wasn't really sure about how that would work with a customer asking a question and then get presented with kind of five. Is it the subsequent questions that you're going to be using the chatbot for, or is it a different thing?
Yeah, that's a good question. So first of all, I'll take a little bit of a detour and I'll mention in mobile apps.
Okay.
In mobile apps, it's almost an identical experience to the web, you know, and the context now isn't a web page, but it's where you are in the app. But very similar experience. The user would click on a button and out would pop a little panel that would have a set of questions to choose from. So that's very similar.
Mm-hmm.
However, chatbots are a little bit different. And the reason is, on the website or in a mobile app, it's relatively easy to ascertain context,
mm-hmm.
given where someone is on the website or in the app and what steps they've taken to get where they are. They kind of have a path that they followed, and that establishes context. In chatbots, it's different because just like in any kind of text messaging platform, you and I can have a conversation on a certain topic over text messaging, and then we go radio silent for a week or two and then pop up and start a completely different discussion on a different topic.
Mm.
In other words, context can switch kind of immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we've come up with is a user interface for chatbots that allows us to establish that context. And it goes something like this. Let's say you're a user of a company's product and you're having a problem with that. So you go to the chatbot and you want to get help. Well, one way you could do it is, you know, using your two thumbs on your mobile device, you could type a long-winded question trying to explain all the details, and then a chatbot could try to parse that.
Mm.
And I think many of us have had that kind of experience, and it doesn't work all that well. It's extremely difficult with today's technology to kind of figure that out and have a satisfying interaction.
Sure.
So our approach is a little bit different. What we do is you engage the chatbot, and the first thing our chatbot does is it serves up a handful of categories of areas of inquiry that you might have. And right now we're deployed on Facebook Messenger as the first chatbot that we've deployed. So
right.
They have something called a carousel where the user can swipe through a handful of different categories, and we typically have images associated with them. So you might swipe through, you know, let's say it's a widget product. It might be, you know, setup, purchasing, returns, you know, whatever. So you have a handful of categories.
So like a phone tree type of
category.
Kind of options, set of options.
Like
in
a
many
phone
ways.
Tree, but more accessible in the sense that you can easily swipe through them rather than listening to them in kind of chronological order.
Yeah.
But like a phone tree. And then once the user selects that category, that's tantamount to navigating to a portion of a website. Now we have some context, and we have the leverage of knowing that the, you know, the past 10,000 visitors that selected setup for their widget, you know, these are the handful of popular questions that they've asked, which is dynamic and it's changing all the time. But then we serve up another carousel by which the person can swipe through and select, oh, that third question about the, you know, configuring the widget for time of day, that's what I really had in mind. They click on that and they get their answer.
Right.
So once again, we've used the chatbot so that it's a kind of identify the topic and question you have in mind and with a few clicks get your answer rather than typing in and trying to frame the question appropriately, which is a far more difficult task than just recognizing the question you have and saying, oh, yeah, that's what I had in mind, and click on it and get your answer.
Right.
So it's a little bit different interface than most are familiar with, but it leverages this whole concept that we use of understanding context to predict what the issues are.
Right. So, I mean, which is a very different kind of use to, hi, my name's Cyril, I'm here to help you. Do you have a question today that I can help you with? Sort of thing.
Exactly.
So you don't,
and that's our challenge is much easier in some sense. We're offloading some of that cognitive processing to the user because we pose a menu of options, and then it's much easier to select. And the analogy I have here is if you went into a restaurant and they didn't have a menu.
Yeah.
And the waiter or waitress came up and said, what would you like to eat? And you're like, well, whereas when you have a menu, you can flip through and say, oh, yeah, I hadn't even thought of it. But come to think of it, that steak looks really good. I'll have that.
Sure.
Whereas left to your own devices, you wouldn't necessarily think of it. So having a menu helps a lot. Restaurants are a few hundred years ahead of the help systems out there on the internet today.
Bill, I mean that sounds good. I mean, I think your use of chatbots in and having the customer set the context is really interesting. And it just kind of it's very nuanced relative to the broader kind of conversation, because I think it feels like you're trying not to be too clever but more smart in the use of that sort of technology, which I think is fascinating. But can you get?
I haven't seen anyone else that has this sort of approach. Yeah.
Yeah. No. I just think it's kind of as I say, it's, I mean, not being clever, not trying to be too clever, sort of thing, and almost trying to humanize the chatbot, but actually just utilize the technology to solve problems. If that makes sense.
Yeah. I think that's a good way to characterize it.
But I tell you what, given that we talked about some of those big numbers before, I mean, can you give us a couple of real examples of, you know, how you've helped some of your clients kind of, and what sort of problems they had, and what sort of what they've done with your technology and kind of what sort of results they've seen, just to sort of bring it to life, if that's possible?
Sure. So one of our customers, it's a company called Tire Buyer, and they sell automobile tires online.
Okay.
And it turns out that when you're buying tires online, there's a lot of questions that people tend to have. Not only will these tires fit on my car, or maybe I have customized rims and will they fit on those rims and so on, but also, can I get these tires delivered to the service station down the street that's actually going to install them for me?
Mm-hmm.
And what if they don't fit? Can I return them? And what's the warranty on the tires that you sell? And a bunch of other things like that. And because tires are a relatively expensive purchase.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, many hundreds of dollars, maybe over $1,000 if you buy a set of four of them. People definitely want to get those questions answered before they're going to click that buy button.
Sure.
And so this company wanted to experiment with, you know, could this help their checkout process? And so they didn't install AnswerDash on the front portion of their website when their customers are selecting amongst tires and so on. But once they go to the checkout page, then our tab appears there. And so their checkout page isn't cluttered with a bunch of Q&A because they want it to be very simple to make it easier to check out. But if people do have questions, the tab is there with a little question mark on it, and they can click on it, and out it pops with these typical questions that people would have, again, dynamically predicted and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so they ran an A-B experiment, and they found out that their conversions were 13% higher when they had the tab on the checkout page than when they didn't.
Cool.
And of course, those are kind of that's a mind-blowing number. And they said, no, that can't be right. There has to be something wrong. So they turned it off. They waited 30 days, and then they double-checked everything and re-instrumented and then ran it again, and it came in, and they basically confirmed the number that for a what they call a considered purchase, which is expensive, like tires, people really are benefit greatly from having answers to those questions at their fingertips. And the way we can do that both non-obtrusively but effectively.
Mm.
In other words, we didn't get in the way of the checkout process, and yet we made it the information readily available to people. Was a very successful way to be able to deliver this kind of value.
Cool. Have you got another example?
I guess I would. Another one would be Moo.com or Moo, which is an online printer, and they have a very high market share and great customer satisfaction ratings in printing business cards.
Yeah, we love
them. And they've deployed, I'm amazed at the brand recognition and the amount of people that use Move for business cards. But they deployed AnswerDash across their website, and they didn't get one single benefit. It wasn't all about, well, we want to reduce our cost of support tickets. Turns out one of the things they do is they delight their customers. And so it wasn't just reducing support costs, but it was also about enhancing the customer experience and getting, you know, better NPS scores, or however you want to measure it, as well as increasing conversions. It turns out designing a business card online has many steps. It can be pretty complicated. You select the paper type and the different card types, and now I need to upload my logo and what formats do you support, and I need to pick fonts and colors. And so it's a multi-step process, and at every step along the way, people are going to tend to have different kinds of questions.
Yeah.
When I'm deciding how big to make my logo, I might have questions about, well, is it better to be JPEG or EPS format or whatever it might be, or how do I specify colors of fonts, and you know, do you use there's different formats for specifying colors and whatnot. So again, if I had an FAQ, I'd have 100 questions, and then the poor user has to read through 100 questions. But when they're dynamically presented in context, you know, when I'm figuring out what logo to use, there's 5 or 6 or 8 questions about logos that I can easily read through and get the one that is of interest to me without being bogged down about how do I pick fonts, because that's not the context that I'm in.
Sure.
So the advantage that Moo had is we reduced the number of tickets they have.
Mm-hmm.
We increased the customer satisfaction ratings that they had, and we increased the conversions, the number of people that started designing a business card and actually got to check out and purchase the business card. So they got kind of benefits in all three dimensions. So no one of them was an eye-popping number, but the combination of the three was kind of tailor-made for what they were looking to do. Of course, they want to have the best customer experience, because fundamentally, that's going to lead to better sales.
Sure.
But they want to do it in a way that's cost-effective, and we kind of aided them in all three of those goals that they had set for themselves. So that's one where it's not necessarily one eye-popping number, but it's just it's just a better experience, which leads to good outcomes or good metrics across all of those fronts for them.
Perfect. So let me ask you this. I mean, Bill, so if somebody's kind of like saying, I speak to lots of different kind of companies, and I kind of, you know, and there's an old piece of research that says, you know, 60% of all calls into your contact center or emails into your support desk or something come about because people can't find the answer to their kind of problem on your kind of like kind of website. And it seems to have been a perennial problem for some time. And right. So self-service is kind of the is a way of trying to kind of address, you know, address that. But if there's somebody, there's some people that are sort of not quite getting it right, and they're, or they're maybe just a little bit late to the you know, the party for whatever reason, and they want to, a business wants to improve their self-service and utilize kind of new tech to kind of help their customers. I mean, what first steps would the, would you recommend the, you know, they should take, or where should they start on this kind of journey? Because it generally is a journey to get this kind of right. Because it's not just you can buy something, add water, then ta-da. It's, you know, you have right, an instant right. solution. It requires work and thinking and, you know, and deliberate action, I guess. So where should they start?
Yeah, I think the first thing that people should do, and this is, if you had asked me this question, I would have had a different answer for you a year and a half ago. But in working with many, many customers and seeing how they adopt and when they're successful and when they're not, I think the first thing that they have to answer is, what is their strategy around customer service?
Right.
And by that I mean, are they trying to leverage excellent customer service to drive sales? Do they want to be kind of a very high touch, high engagement, and that's the way they differentiate themselves from competitors?
Mm-hmm.
Or do they want to minimize their customer support costs, perhaps so they can optimize on some other dimension? Perhaps they want to optimize and be the low price leader.
Sure.
And a lot of times we, say a year ago, we would engage with a company and it wasn't clear to them or to us where they were on that spectrum between kind of high touch customer service, kind of the valet experience,
sure.
or low cost, but they're going to optimize on something else, performance or price or something.
Yeah.
If you know, or if you can articulate where you are on that spectrum, and many times, you know, we'll talk to multiple parties within a company and they don't agree. It you know, as an enterprise, they don't have a common vision of what they're trying to accomplish.
Right.
But if you know what you're doing, then you can deploy the technology to in pursuit of that goal.
Right.
Let's say I'm the low-cost leader. I sell the cheapest widgets out there, and support costs, in order to give a low cost on my widgets, I have to reduce my support costs.
Yeah.
I'm going to make certain decisions about the way I staff my support line, how much self-service I want, and so on, that would be very different than if I'm going to be the customer satisfaction leader and I'm going to deliver high customer satisfaction at all costs because I have a high margin item and I want lots of repeat business.
Yeah.
I think that's the most fundamental question that you have to answer. And once you have a clear shared understanding within an enterprise of where you are on that spectrum, then you can start to make decisions that bolster that strategy.
Perfect. I mean, that's good advice. Thanks. Thank you for that, Bill. So, Bill, you talked about being a startup, but you've got a bunch of sort of good big name kind of clients and stuff. I mean, what's the next big thing or next big challenge for you guys? What, you know, which mountain are you going to conquer next?
Yeah. So we started out as a web based company, and the lion's share of our customers and our revenue is still generated from deployments on the web. And so the next thing that we want to do is have more emphasis or get more traction on the other two products that we have, which are our service that we offer for mobile apps.
Mm-hmm.
And we have SDKs or development kits that our customers can use to integrate this system into iOS and Android apps. So get more traction there. And the other one is Chatbot, which is, as I mentioned, Facebook Messenger. We have a Chatbot technology available for that channel, but we want to expand into other channels, including Slack and Skype and other kind of enterprise-ready channels where I think our technology can bring great benefit.
Okay.
And then the last area is just to leverage our AI more broadly. We've developed a lot of natural language processing technology to kind of analyze these questions. And one, I'll just give an example. When we identify categories in our chatbot that people can choose from, remember how I discussed how you can swipe through the carousel and pick a category?
Yeah.
We've developed technology that will analyze a knowledge base of questions and answers and automatically distill out from that the 6 or 8 or 10 categories that best characterize that knowledge base. That's some really cool technology, and we're looking for other ways that we can leverage that in this whole self-service support category, because we think we have some really powerful underlying technology, and looking for other ways to leverage that is kind of the next thing that we're looking at.
It seems to me that the a way to go would be, you know, for example, you talked about the two different types of, or the spectrum of types of service that you wanted to do. It's almost like a deflection, low-cost option, or a high-touch, high-value option. It seems to me that there seems to be an obvious application, which would be an internal kind of knowledge base that helps your agents or your representatives can provide that. It gives them access to all that information that they need, but do it in a very, very quickly, in a very, very quick, a very smart sort of way.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that. One of the things that we're working on now is what we call an agent-facing tool.
Yes.
So in addition to the self-service tools that we have out for the end users, an agent-facing tool that just makes their job a lot easier. And I mentioned the natural language processing or NLP technology that mm-hmm. we have. One of the ways we can leverage that is monitoring a text messaging dialogue between a consumer and an agent, and based on that back and forth, suggest to the agent, these are the kinds of pieces of information that the consumer is looking for. And therefore, rather than have the agent, you know, type in a bunch of search commands through a knowledge base and pour over data, just serve it up to them so that in a point-and-click fashion, the agent can say, based on the conversation, oh yeah, they're interested in what color our widgets come in. Here's the canned answer, click a button, boom,
yeah.
And the answer goes out on that text platform. So that is the next kind of natural extension of what originally we developed as consumer-facing tools can also have great benefit as an agent-facing tool, just to make that engagement between the consumer and the agent that much more efficient, that much quicker.
Yeah, no, I've seen lots of people kind of building those kind of knowledge bases kind of for their agents, and it just can make their job so much better and so much easier, and it just takes a lot of the drudgery kind of out of it. So searching around across probably sometimes over multiple systems is can be a real pain.
Yeah. Right.
So, Bill, is there anything that I've kind of missed out, or something that you want to add before I ask you my kind of two final kind of questions? Because I know you're a busy guy. But is there anything that we've missed out?
No, I mean, I think we hit on the high points, and you see the common themes that I've talked about, that by leveraging context of users and past behavior of similar users, we can really do a surprisingly good job of predicting future behaviors, what questions they have, what purchases they're likely to make, and so on. And we're just scratching the surface on how we can mine that data in order to have better experiences, more successful outcomes, and so on. I think it's a whole area that, you know, and we're hearing a lot about AI and prediction and so on. And this is just one little area where we're doing that, is predicting behaviors and needs of consumers, and kind of how we can tap into that and create value from it is almost limitless. It's pretty exciting.
Perfect. So that brings me to my last two questions, and the first one is related to a book I wrote last year called How to Wow. And since it came out, what I've been doing and is asking everybody that I have interviewed on the podcast is to get their perspective on what Wow service or experience means to them. So I'd be really interested to get your thoughts on that, Bill.
Yeah, I've given this a little thought. I mean, from my perspective, a Wow experience means that a company, an enterprise, is actively engaged throughout their customer's life cycle, not just at one point or another. And by, when I say throughout the customer life cycle, I mean pre-sales, post-sales, hopefully into repeat sales.
Mm-hmm.
So anticipating what prospective customers might need or want, helping those prospective customers as they make their purchase decision and as they need information along the way, and then engaging with them in anticipation of what their follow-up needs might be in terms of repeat purchases or purchasing supplemental or complementary products and so on. I think that's something, a direction that a lot of companies are moving in. It comes largely from the observation that our existing customers are our richest source of new customers. You know, getting a customer to repeat purchase is a lot more efficient than finding a random person in the universe that might turn into a customer one day. And so having kind of embracing that entire customer lifecycle in a way that customers find inobtrusive but helpful, mm-hmm. I think customers would welcome that. And obviously it's going to take a lot to figure out how to do that right and not overdo it and so on. But I think that kind of experience would truly be kind of the wow experience. That's the way we think about it.
Perfect.
And people talk about it a lot. One example is, you know, opening a box for a new Apple product.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a trivial thing, but Apple has taken that to a level where, you know, that's half the fun of it.
Sure.
And so getting that from even before someone's a customer all the way to when they're repeat purchasing, have that new box experience like opening an Apple product would be the wow experience. And obviously there's a great opportunity to use technology to automate that and make it really work.
Perfect. So Bill, that brings me to my final question that I always ask at the end of these interviews. And the question is this: is there anything that you would like to shamelessly plug?
Sure, people probably guess what it is. I mean, I've described a lot about customer success and customer support and things that companies should look for. And obviously along the way, I've said how I think we address the problem. But I really do think that AnswerDash can do a lot to help companies deliver a wow experience, at least along certain parts today of that customer lifecycle, and hopefully over time, you know, more and more of that lifecycle. So I invite people to check out our website. Just go to answerdash.com and they can see a little bit more how it works. And visuals do a lot better job than I can do in expressing it in just words. But go take a look at answerdash.com and let us know what you think.
Bill, thank you so much for that. So thanks for sharing your time and your insights and sort of helping us look under the hood a little bit about how your technology works. And I just want to say, yeah, thanks very much for sharing your time and your experience with us. That's been great.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, Adrian, and best of luck going forward.